Hello, I'm Rupert Sheldrake. I'm here with Mark Vernon for another in our series of dialogues. And this time, I want to talk, Mark, about your actual book, your new book on Dante.
I'd be very happy to do that, of course. Flagging yes. It up for those who are watching in full colour.
Very good. Well, I'm a tremendous fan of this book. I think it's incredibly helpful. I've been aware of Dante's Divine Comedy for, you know, decades. But despite several attempts to read it, I've never really got very far. I couldn't understand what it was about. I couldn't follow the not very good translation I was using. It didn't make much sense to me. And yet I knew it was enormously important as a seminal book in the whole of our culture and civilization. When I read your book, I started reading it. I haven't finished it yet. I'm still on book one, The Inferno. I found this incredibly helpful because it suddenly all makes sense to me. It comes into focus. And what you do in the book, in a series of short chapters, is go through the different sections or cantos of Dante. In your chapters, you have these marvelously brief one-word titles like afraid, overwhelmed, weight, rage, nastiness, stench, boiling, decay, fame, reputation. Wonderful the way you've managed to get a single word for each one as a heading. And in it, you portray this journey that Dante took into the underworld with Virgil as his guide. And you show how the different people who are suffering in the Inferno are suffering for very recognizable problems in people's lives still today. And what you show is this isn't some kind of arbitrary torture chamber of some wrathful, vengeful God who creates a hell because he enjoys watching people suffering. What you show is that the sufferings that people are undergoing in the Inferno are very much related to the actual dispositions and activities they had when they were alive. There's a sense in which there's a natural justice in what's happening. They're sort of trapped in patterns of behavior that they were trapped in when they were alive. And because they're trapped in them, they can't get out of them. And that's why they're trapped in these different regions of the Inferno or hell. And what you do is show that Dante is giving us a kind of taxonomy of sufferings and violations of the natural order and the moral order. And showing how these lead to consequences which are a natural result of these attitudes themselves. Would you say that's a fair summary of what you're doing?
Yes, thank you very much. Yeah, no, I was really keen in writing the book to try and present one that tracks Dante's inner journey into these inner realms of the world as we know it on the surface every day. The book's called Dante's Divine Comedy, A Guide for the Spiritual Journey, for that reason. And I think that going back to your initial thoughts about wrestling to find a way into it, I think part of the trouble actually is that many of the commentaries or notes that come with translations are very good about the historical meaning of things, the part it played in Dante's political life, about the poetry, the translation, all that, but very few are really keen on trying to track how Dante himself changes. And so how, as he changes, more of reality opens up to him. And that begins with the descent into the Inferno, but importantly carries on up Mount Purgatory and into Paradise, which we'll pick up, I hope, very much in a subsequent conversation. Because one of my other things about the Divine Comedy is that very often people say, oh yeah, we can make some sense of the Inferno. It does relate to trapped, stuck, tortured lives. But it's really important that that's just the first stage of the journey. And it's quite a sign of our times, I think, that people struggle with the paradise in particular, which is when real knowledge starts to show up for Dante. But yeah, in the Inferno, that the descent is it's a participative descent as well, by which I mean that I think that you only know these realms, the darker realms as well as the light ones, when you share in them in some way. You know, they can be described, but Dante has to enter into them. And so he encounters the hellish parts of himself as much as sees it in others, and then appreciates how, as you put it, which is another really important point, that it's actually part of the order of creation as well. So that's a long way of saying, I'm glad that, you know, as you've been getting into it, that's kind of what you've picked up.
Very good. Well, perhaps for those who are not familiar with the Inferno or with Dante, it would be helpful if you could actually explain a few of the examples. For example, there's a section about what happens to lovers who are trapped in hell. And, love isn't bad. We all know that. But it's an excess that seems to be the problem. Could you just explain that section, for example?
Yeah, so it comes quite early on when Dante and Virgil have walked through the famous gates of hell, abandon hope, and they've walked through limbo and are into some of the upper circles of hell, where the kind of guide 101 to Dante would say people are wrestling with their desires and how desire takes you off track. And of course, we know that love can take us off track, as well as being sort of hugely powerful. And I think a big theme throughout Dante is how, particularly erotic love, which, you know, the Christian tradition isn't always so good on, but how erotic love can stir these huge desires within us. But guided aright, developed aright, can lead us, therefore, to the greatest fulfillment of our desire, which is God. But in this early stage of the Inferno, he comes across particularly the figure of Francesca de Rimini and her lover Paolo, who was also her brother-in-law. And it's one of the most famous bits of the Inferno. Dante sees them in great swirls of winds and hurricanes, which is a kind of physical experience of how love can make you feel like you're caught up in a whirlwind and knock you off your feet, which is both thrilling and deeply disturbing at the same time. And what Dante does is present both the appeal of this, and particularly Francesca's words are very beautiful and enticing. She basically talks about the excitement of falling in love, which is some experience that many, many people have had. And the roller coaster that is so incredible, because it feels like it's just injecting life with an overload of meaning. But you wonder why this is being talked about in these parts of hell. And you start to realize that Francesca has fallen in love with love itself, so that love is no longer taking her anywhere. For example, she doesn't actually mention her lover by name. She's already in a way using her lover Paolo just to get the trip, just to have the kind of peak experience. And it remains completely, well, nowadays we might say, unintegrated with the rest of her life, and so can't take her anywhere. She's just kind of addicted to the rush. And so that's what Dante sees and also hears. But it's very interesting too that it's too much for Dante to hear at this moment, because at the end of this canto, he actually collapses in a dead faint. And I think that what this is also about is this experience of erotic love, which is so powerful for Dante in his own life. Very famously, he is sparked on this journey by his falling in love with the woman Beatrice, who meets him finally at the end of Purgatory. And so he is also seeing himself how the compulsions that arise when you fall in love can be your undoing as much as the making of you. So it's a really important early encounter for Dante too, given that he's got to try and expand his ability almost to ride the sights of erotic love, but that take him to the vision of God, vision of the all, rather than keeping him trapped in that rather tunnel vision that infatuation can keep us trapped in.
Yes, that's so interesting, and it makes such good sense. So it's amazing. I mean, scales fell from my eyes, Mark, when I read your book, and I took your advice and got the Penguin translation and then read the cantos themselves. I'm still only halfway through Hell because it's not the kind of book that's a page-turning, ripping good yarn where you've got to find out, you know, who done it and that sort of thing. It takes a while to read each chapter and assimilate what you're saying. So that's one reason I appreciate the brief chapters and the way it's divided into bite-sized chunks, as the Divine Comedy is itself. And also the way that you bring your experience as a psychotherapist to bear on these incidents.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is, again, I'm you know, really glad that you're finding it like that, because I think that to try and enter into the feeling of each canto is part of going on the journey with Dante. And so it's potentially then delivering all that the book can deliver, because Dante himself is quite clear that he writes partly for his own benefit to understand the things that were happening to him, but also for our benefit. And he means the future. He wrote 700 years ago, but he means us now by following him. And he says in many points, he quite often breaks the fourth wall and addresses us readers direct and says, look, are you following what's going on? Which is done partly by describing what happens, who he meets, but also by the allusions and the way that each canto is written. You know, so the allusions to myth and so on are all about trying to stir up the mood of that particular moment in order to be with him in that particular place. But, you know, the psychotherapy is important too, because for me, the Divine Comedy only really started making sense when I was in my own analysis, which was quite a traditional analysis, really. I went many times a week for quite a few years. And what it helped me with was realizing that what felt like, particularly the descent part, trying to, you know, confront my fears and anxieties and so on, which became quite powerful during the experience. I mean, in some ways, a thoroughgoing analysis is a kind of controlled breakdown. And that's sort of what the descent part of the journey is. But reading Dante kind of helped me hold on to what was going on, particularly this first part, because I realized it is a potentially universal experience. It's not just me stuck in my private torture chamber, but is something which other people have experienced. And moreover, is part of the spiritual journey. And so it helped me to keep kind of going and not just feeling I was going up a one-way street and about to get stuck forever, which is of course what lots of the figures in Hell feel. They do feel they're going to be stuck there forever. So you know, relating it to personal experience, you know, of all sorts, didn't even be psychotherapy, of course. I mean, people will talk about peak experiences that can be very disturbing as much as journeys into light. And of course, events that happen in life too can leave you flummoxed. So someone like Primo Levi said he found Dante's Inferno helpful in the concentration camps because it told him that his experience even there could have meaning. So hence that's part of its power too.
Very good. Well, that again makes total sense to me. I wonder if perhaps you could help us with one or two more sections. And one that struck me was fame, and the chapter on fame. I mean, fame, we live in a world where there's probably more fame than ever before. Celebrity culture has vastly expanded the realm of fame and people's aspirations to fame. And so what does Dante have to tell us about that?
I mean, he was already famous by the time he came to write the Divine Comedy. He writes it at the beginning of the 14th century. So scholars reckon he started about 1308, when he was in the midpoint of his life, as he famously opens. And he was already well known. He was not only a very well-known poet and one who had already developed what was called the sweet new style. So it was very significant in that respect, but also as a well-known politician. He'd been one of the priors of the city-state of Florence in this late medieval, early modern period. And so kind of partly he's wrestling with his own fame, but he encounters in this section one of his teachers who's called Bruno Latini. And I think broadly the idea is that in their exchange, Dante sees how fame can trap you, because you, in a way, partly become famous just for being famous. So there's very little substance, actually, when you start to look. But also you can get addicted to your own fame. And you know, this needn't be, you know, world famous celebrities. It's something which, in a way, everyone experiences, whether it's like being known in the office, how you feel you're seen and not seen amongst your friends or in your family even. And the great risk is that you hook your own, well, not just longevity, but the possibility even for being remembered after your death, even your life in eternity, on the impression that you make in this life. It's an idea actually that goes back to Plato. Plato had said that it's very easy for us humans to seek alternatives to eternal life by trying to make an impact in this life, whether it be through fame, whether it be through making money, whether it be through you know, being celebrated in one way or another. And Dante has to work this out again, because he's already, I think, by this stage, getting a sense that his work, The Divine Comedy, is going to sort of be his masterpiece. It's going to eclipse even the work that he'd done to date. And, you know, it's so easy to fall in love with your own creation and hook your vitality to it, when he must work out all the time how it's fine being famous, but so long as you're famous for more than yourself. So you become then a kind of channel or lens through which people see God's fame in particular, you know, do see eternal life. They see more and more richness, not just who you are as a person. You know, and again, this makes a lot of sense, because I don't know, I remember once meeting the Dalai Lama by chance, in quite a small gathering, in fact. You know, a hugely famous person walks in the room, but immediately you got the sense that he's not just a celebrity. Because with him walked this whole sense of life as well, that wasn't just kind of sparkling in the way that celebrity can be, but that as particularly the longer you're with him, rather than just thinning out like celebrity can, it deepened and it felt like he transmitted more and more. And, you know, that to me is a good kind of fame. You know, I don't think fame is bad in itself. It's what it brings with it, if that makes some sense.
Oh, it makes sense to me. I've also met the Dalai Lama a couple of times in small gatherings. And like you, I had the feeling it's not all about him. Look at me, I'm the Dalai Lama. You feel that there's something flowing through him. Compassion, I suppose, is how he'd see it as, you know, as a Buddhist. But it's just something flows through him, humor. He behaves in this not affected, humble way. Very good sense of humor, puts everyone at their ease. You feel that something flowing through him that's not just about him. So I think that puts it really well, and he's a very good example of it. The Queen's an example too, actually. I mean, the Queen... the Queen of, she's the Queen of the United Kingdom, a head of the Commonwealth, and so forth. You know, all the history, all the pomp, all that kind of thing. And yet, in her presence, and when you see her, she's putting people at their ease. She's asking people how they are. You feel it's not about her personally. It's about something flowing through her. And so, I think that puts it very well. But how does it relate to moving on to another chapter, which comes, I think, soon after it, reputation? How would you relate it? How does it differ from his discussion of reputation?
Yeah, so it's in the similar part of the Inferno. This is, you know, fairly low down now. It's on the area called the Burning Sands, which him and Virgil walk across. It's, you know, it's a good image because it's kind of like the light of fame and reputation, but it's falling like flames of rain. And so it's actually scorching and burning people rather than being a true light that lightens up the rest of the world. And so very soon after meeting Bruno Latini, he meets these other characters who are actually kind of nouveau riche in the Florence of his time. Florence had become very wealthy because of mercantilism, which was really getting going in the 14th century, 13th and 14th century, sometimes called the first industrial revolution now. But banking in particular, so the ability to borrow and lend secured by banks, the Florentine, was also part of that story. And these are characters who've made a lot of money in that way. And they see Dante and spot that he's wearing Florentine dress, and so immediately get drawn towards him because they wonder who that might be. And you get the sense quite quickly that they want to know, is Dante himself someone who is going to be able to help them? Is he going to be in the sense of they're stuck still in their mortal mentality of wanting to cut deals, wanting to climb the greasy ladder, wanting to know people insofar as they can use the people that they know, or that the people that they know can do favors for them and so on, all that kind of nepotism, cronyism dynamic. And so it's reputation in the negative sense that you realize. Dante almost says it's a bit like going to a party, meeting someone, and then realizing the person's instantly looking over your shoulder to see who's more important in the room. And so, it's a negative form of reputation, because there is a good kind of reputation. We need no go further than the Dalai Lama, who has a massive reputation, but it's one that radiates life, not sucks life into itself and discards you the minute that you're not going to be any use to them. So the themes are kind of related, and it's quite a nice indication of how the perception of things deepens and develops as you go through successive cantos, which is what happens across this particular region of the Burning Sands.
Mm. Well, I think we've probably got time for one more. I'm loving this, Mark. I just love the way you can summarize things. It's one of your great strengths. When you summarize our dialogues, when they go online, you have an amazing gift for this. And so if you'll indulge me, could I ask you about rage to move up to a slightly higher level of the Inferno? And what do we learn from that?
Yes, so rage is depicted as people kind of locked in battle. And so they're constantly flying at each other. And that, in a way, is what rage is like, as opposed to anger. So this is, again, another sort of key distinction that Dante's got to learn by descending into the dark version, the shadow, because anger actually turns out to be a good energy when it leads you to want to seek more than just what has sparked your anger. Whereas when you get trapped in anger, it turns into rage, which just kind of eats you up. And so I think that's partly what Dante is learning there. I mean, sometimes it's called kind of righteous anger, which is a way of summarizing it. But to always know that anger is a kind of surface emotion, and beneath it will be something else, It might be a cry for righteousness. It might be vulnerability. You know, sometimes anger is a kind of defense, and you must let go of the anger in order to realize how you feel vulnerable underneath. And then vulnerability is a softer emotion, so that can lead to more. The other element of anger, rage, that Dante sees is that whilst it leads some people constantly to attack others and never address themselves, which is something very familiar in life, it can also just turn in on you. And so there are other people that are gripped by rage, but they're depicted as lying on a kind of seabed in the mud. And all Dante sees is these bubbles coming out of their lives. And, you know, in psychotherapeutic terms, this is a powerful image of one form, at least, of depression. When, if you work with someone with depression, it might be many things that are involved, but one element that can be there is how they're so furious with something or someone in life, but it's got trapped inside them. And so it drains away all their energy. And sometimes an agitated depression is a bit like this. So Dante sees that too. In these powerful images, and you know, he was angry. He gets very angry, particularly with the popes of his time, Pope Boniface VIII, who famously he mostly meets in the Inferno, not wholly, but he mostly meets the Inferno. But he must learn not just to enjoy, as it were, kicking the Pope while he's down, because that's not going to lead him anywhere. He must use that anger to start to see more, which is what happens when they enter Mount Purgatory, which maybe we'll talk about next time. I mean, maybe I should just say something about the floor of hell. So in a way, we've kind of covered the Inferno in this conversation, at least by getting to the nadir of reality. I hope this isn't going to be a spoiler alert for you, but it's one of Dante's big reveals, actually, is on the floor of hell, which isn't fiery and burning. That would have far too much life for how Dante sees the real pit of hell. It's actually frozen solid, and Lucifer, the angel who was closest to God, the angel of light, as Lucifer means, has so far fallen from the divine that he's almost fallen out of existence itself, and so hence is depicted as in this frozen state. And it's also, though, still a moment of wonder and even light, because the way out of the Inferno, it turns out, is by crawling actually onto the body of Lucifer. And it's when they do that that Virgil and Dante realize they've begun the ascent and begun the journey up Mount Purgatory. You might think that Virgil might say to Dante, okay, look, we've seen the worst, seen Lucifer, now let's turn round and go back. But Dante realizes it's by going into the darkness and bringing your mind, bringing your understanding, bringing your desire and the light of God, even to that darkest place, that the turnaround happens. And that feels, you know, tremendously insightful to me as well, because there's a huge temptation, particularly if you're religious, to want to kind of get rid of the bad bits, get rid of the bits you don't like. But Dante's saying, no, those bits have got something for you, which might actually be really crucial, in fact, if you can understand them and turn them around so they become desires or thoughts that lead you to God. You must know about this in your own work, which, you know, at times does meet anger, does even meet hate. But to engage with that creates the possibility that it can turn around, because sometimes people they boil when they're about to change. In fact, they're about to sort of precipitate into a new perception. So, you know, I hope that makes sense to you as well.
Well, it does. I can't wait to get to the floor of hell. I haven't got that far yet in my journey through your book and through Dante. But this is totally fascinating, Mark. I think it's a fantastic job you've done here. And I look forward to discussing books 2 and 3, Purgatory, and does he call it heaven or the
celestial? Paradiso, yeah, paradise, paradiso.
Paradise, yeah. Yes. Very good. Well, thank you very much.
Well, look, thanks for picking up on the book, Rupert, and appreciate what you say about it, because I really hope that it can open things up for people. It, you know, it is one of those books I can honestly say has changed my life. And I do think it's a labyrinth that if you can find a way in, is utterly transformative, in fact, for now, as much as for when Dante wrote it.
Well, wonderful. Well, to be continued. But I love the fact that as Virgil guides Dante through these realms, you guide us through Virgil and Dante. So you're like kind of Virgil squared, as it were, leading us through. It's wonderful. Anyway, more later on this.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Cheers. Bye for now.